welcome to Back from the Abyss. I'm Dr. Craig Heacock. Today, I sit down with my good friend Saj Razvi, a frequent guest on Back from the Abyss and my go-to person on all things trauma. Together, Saj and I discuss a recent listener letter as well as implications for trauma treatment in general. I think this episode will primarily be of interest to therapists, but still, I think there's something in here for all of you. I get so many emails from you listeners, and it's really one of the highlights of this podcast. I get, gosh, beautiful anecdotes and stories and thank yous and sometimes pleas for help or treatment advice. I got a letter recently that really struck me, and I immediately contacted the listener, a woman named Laura, and I said, could I read your letter on the podcast? And I said, could I sit down with Saj and we could discuss it? Because she actually mentioned Saj in the letter. And so right now I'm in Saj Ravsi's basement. Hey, Saj.
Welcome, Craig. Welcome to my basement.
Yeah, it's good to be in your basement. And my sheets are washing in your washing machine. It's good to be here. So I'm going to read this letter, and then I'm going to let Saj kind of lead it, because she brings up just, I think, some of the most powerful and thoughtful questions of anyone who's ever written into me, and I knew Saj would be the person to start to address these. So here we go. Hi, Dr. Heacock. In recent months, I've become a regular listener of Back from the Abyss. I first found you through the episodes with Saj Razvi when I was learning about PSIP, which is Saj's psychedelic somatic model. And after finishing those, I just kept listening. Thank you for your heartfelt work, curiosity, and honesty in the field of psychiatry and healing. As someone relatively new to psychedelics, your podcast has become a trustworthy place to become more educated, aware, and inspired. Thank you for that. I'm 40 years old and have been on a healing quest most of my adult life. My trauma is developmental, an elusive diagnosis that took until 2016 to discover. My experiences were mostly of neglect, deeply insufficient emotional and relational attunement and connection. The trauma part of that comes from cry it out and some minor birth trauma, quote unquote minor birth trauma. But the question I'm asking about is related to the emotional void that comes from not having attuned and caring adults throughout development. I'm reminded of Saj talking about the experience of knowing love for the first time through psychedelic experiences, common to many people with this kind of emotional neglect. Despite many years of therapy, of somatic work, and even a couple of psilocybin sessions, my own emotional void remains. Through these avenues, I've tasted what it's like to feel loved, attuned to, and accepted in these deep, unreachable places. The resulting sense of self-worth and embodiment changes everything, absolutely everything, about the way I feel and show up in my day-to-day life. However, so far the resulting sense of self from these experiences has not been sustainable. The sense of being loved, seen, and welcomed always fades. And chronic insecurity, low self-worth, and resulting shame and disappointment return. I'm a somatic practitioner myself, and I wonder, both for myself and for those I work with, what does it take? What does it really take for an existential sense of belonging? A knowing one is existentially loved and lovable, and secure self-esteem to endure in a person's felt sense. We know that much of life would be 1,000 times easier had these developmental needs that shape identity and self-esteem been met. So what does it truly take to fill the void left by lack of attuned nurture? I do believe it's possible, but I'm uncertain what is required to tip the scales to a sustained sense of existential love that makes self-worth and a life of satisfying relationships in the here and now more possible. Any insights you're willing to share on this topic, I'd love to hear. Thank you again for your beautiful, beautifully real podcast. Thanks, Laura. So I'm going to first turn this over to Saj, and then I'll weigh in as needed.
Yeah. So the first thought that I have about that is that we're not talking about a void. We're not talking about an open space that these new experiences are being had inside of, right? What we're talking about is these core developmental experiences that people have had of aloneness, alienation, isolation, abuse, that really you know, form a lot of our reality, right? So my sense is that we can't just have positive new experiences to lay on top of or alongside with these other experiences, right? There, I think these childhood experiences are ones that we've had in, again, a very developmentally sensitive window, and they're enduring, right? I think they're enduring partly also because they're so incredibly painful, right? So we see this all the time in our trainings, right? That when people sort of go in with medicine and the somatic process, it takes them to early developmental traumas, attachment wounding. And what I've seen with this, Craig, is that it's so exquisitely painful that people would not go there without the support of medicine. Mm-hmm. And
a therapist.
And the therapist relationship. Yeah. Yeah, in a big way. And so I don't see people opening these doors in ordinary states of consciousness. And I think we have to. I think we can't just have sort of positive experiences that are built on top of these very profoundly negative ones. I think we have to engage the darkness. We have to get down there and make contact with it, be in relationship with it. Mm-hmm. And then those places can begin to evolve.
Yeah, it's almost like when I read that letter, it's like she has this void, this emptiness. And she just, like, if I could just pour something in there to sort of fill it up and make it okay, to sort of like take away the void or fill up the void or null the void or, but what you're saying is you got to go into the void.
Yeah. I'm saying there's no void. I'm saying that there is experience we have, even if it's the experience of neglect, that is a formative experience that children have. They make meaning of that experience. Their world is constructed by that experience. So my suggestion is we don't actually ever live in a void. We're constantly referencing some kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If she were your client, patient, and, maybe she brought you this letter, like, this is who I am, this is what I've been through. How would you start to think about working with someone like her and with these kind of developmental neglect, absence trauma?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I think it's wonderful when people do have corrective experiences to that, right? So, you know, somebody grows up with a lot of abandonment, but then later in life, they get into a relationship or they manage to have a family that really communicates to them that the world is a very different place for them now, right? So I think that is actually essential. In fact, we don't see movement in terms of a person's nervous system responses to these early events unless they have that in place. But once they do have that in place, then I think we need to do the work to actually get through the defensive layers of the protective layers that really keep us from those types of memories. You know, if you think about memory reconsolidation theory for a bit, you know, we know that there really takes sort of two factors for us to create this reconsolidated experience. One of them is access to the memory, right? And if you can't access the memory because you're dissociated from it, or you're too guarded against it, then, you know, that process is not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think your love circuitry can be broken? You know, with say profound neglect, absence of love and nurturing and mirroring, and is there a point where actually it's not salvageable? Mm. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean,
because I was going to say attachment circuitry, but I'm interested in that too. But I'm actually interested in love circuitry, because I think that's similar but different. I'd also be curious what you think about just my choice of words there. Is that different?
How are you defining it differently?
I guess I think of attachment as more unconscious. Well, I think of attachment as more of an unconscious primal bond, where I think of love as more, it has those elements, but there's also sort of a conscious knowing that I am unconditionally accepted and loved and okay. you know, like we get from our parents. Like, I think we have attachment ideally to our parents. Like we are drawn to them in this sort of almost like psycho-spiritual energetic way. But I also think ideally through the parent, through the process of good parenting, we not only feel it in our bodies, you know, somatically, but we know it in our minds. Like we are loved. Like these two people love me unconditionally, mm-hmm. and I don't have to do anything to get their love. And there's something just so, I guess that's what I'm talking about, the kind of the love circuitry, which then, you know, you can move forward to sort of parse that out with friendships or with your romantic partner. That idea that I have this unconditional positive regard that I'm going to choose to put onto you. Like years ago, you know, when you and I were getting to be friends, I said, you know, we're going to be good friends and I'm, you know, I'm going to be a good friend to you. And I remember actively choosing, like, I choose Saj. Like, mm-hmm. You know, and it was like a love choice, not an attachment choice. So it was more of, I'm going to choose you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're saying love is more of a conscious experience than attachment.
I'm curious what you think of that. Because it seems like this letter is really talking about both. There's sort of mm-hmm. attachment wounding, but maybe also, I don't know if she uses the word love, but that too, feeling like maybe she can't really be held in a loving, kind of held in an emotional, loving way.
Yeah. I mean, my sense is both of them are bottom-up experiences, right? Most mm-hmm. of both of them are just, you know, if you're lucky enough to have gotten that type of parenting, then that's how you experience the world. That's how you see the world. It's an option. It becomes a conscious option to sort of, you know, extend love to people. I think if you didn't get that, it just becomes a lot harder to be able to find it. You know, I think people can try to have top-down experiences of love, but I think it's not quite the same as it being something that arises out of your, you know, just walking around on on a nice summer day and you experience a sense of love of all existence and, you know, of other people.
Mm-hmm. Right? When you work with people, or you hear, or when you're consulting with people, you know, with deep, early, you know, neglect, attachment wounds, you know, are you sometimes seeing or hearing about people that, again, you think this is too broken? Like this is not addressable, you know, whether with somatic therapy, talk therapy, medicine, you know, psychedelic therapy, that this is just too deep or too profound?
Well, I think that's the thought that goes into personality disorder, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, whatever this particular wound is, it happens so early on in this person's life that, you know, the kernel of who they are was affected by this. And you would imagine that love and attachment is a part of that mm-hmm. for people. So I guess what I'll say about that is I have seen psychedelics work with personality level disturbances. Mm-hmm. I think it's very powerful work. There's a lot of energy that's kind of tied into that sort of that diagnosis for people or that experience for people. And I guess I'm not suggesting that we're even ready as a field to be able to take on that kind of work, but I think it is possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a, what I've seen with it, in other words, is a real deconstruction and reconstruction of self. And I think part of that is this love pathway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you listen to Laura's letter, how much or what role do you hear dissociation being part of this?
Oh.
Because again, I had said something about the void, and you said, no, it's not a void.
Yeah.
But, you know, right when you said that, I thought, oh, yeah, that's probably more the experience of dissociative numbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think dissociation is huge here, right? And the worst parts of our traumas, the most painful parts of our experience of being alive, and in these overwhelming experiences I think the core of that lives in dissociation. It lives in numbness. You know, the lesser things you can rate on a scale, right? So, you know, most probably a lot of your listeners know the SUD scale, the subjective units of distress. It's basically, you know, how bad do you feel on a scale of 1 to 10, right? And then you do an intervention and then ask the question again. And what I find with that is that it's the things that are awful, that are difficult, that rate on that scale, but the things that are truly awful in a person's life don't rate on that scale at all, right? The things that are truly awful, people can talk about with flat affect, right? And so
I think that's part of what happened in the MAP study. I'm thinking of how many people that we would try, you know, we're screening these people and they wouldn't meet criteria, you know, number-wise in terms of the rating scales. But it became increasingly clear over time that I think so many of them were, had spent so much time in dissociation that they weren't having, you know, almost like in schizophrenia, we talk about positive versus negative symptoms. Like they weren't having the hot symptoms, you know?
Yeah.
I remember when I first heard you talk about trauma, kind of talked about the sort of like the hot sympathetic and the cold parasympathetic, that that if you don't have enough hot symptoms, you might not qualify for PTSD on the CAPS or other rating scales, but actually you could have such horrific trauma that you're in this freeze response much of the time, which, but that doesn't show up on, you know, clinical structured interviews or rating scales.
Yeah. Self-assessment of dissociation is not great. You know? Yeah. I remember we touched on this in one of our other talks where, you know, the last person to know that they're dissociated is the person who's dissociated. Right. So yeah, it's a huge defense. And I think the, you know, the core of these existential attachment type experiences live in dissociation, and that when that gets cleared away, by the way, that's an incredible therapeutic opportunity when that gets cleared away, but it also brings about a lot of complications. Yeah,
I got a follow-up email from Laura. I had reached out to her, and then this, let me just read a little bit from her follow-up email because I think this is interesting. She said, I think dissociation is such a bizarre thing, especially dissociation resulting from early trauma. How can you know the degree of your dissociation when you have no experience of wholeness? On the one hand, it's an innate knowing of aliveness and wholeness that drives the quest for healing. Yet on the other hand, psychedelics are teaching me that there is a ton of stored grief and pain in my body that I didn't know I had. It's honestly a bit exasperating that despite a conscious willingness and fierce effort to face the past, these places remained inaccessible.
Yeah. All I would say is that I would agree with that. I think so many people are walking around in a nightmare and then they build a functional life on top of that nightmare. Right. And when we go in with, again, medicine and a body process, you see the nightmare, you see the programming, you see the relationships that are alive down there. Right. This is, we're not talking about the past, right? We're talking about an ever-present reality, an ever-present moment that the person's nervous system is responding to.
That's such a good point. I hadn't really thought of it that way. That, right, you're carrying that into now. Yeah. So again, if she, let's say you were hearing this, you know, as a, you know, a case presentation with somebody, you know, one of the therapists you're working with in the PSIP training, like what would be your kind of primary recommendations in terms of trying to move the needle with her?
Yeah. Well, again, you know, we're starting with the fact that she does know that there are good places in the world, right? We're starting with the fact that she has had these corrective experiences and can hopefully reference them, right? And then once we have that, then we would do the work to sort of start resolving the dissociation, right? To actually get to how this lives in her system. So let me talk about a little a story about that. We were doing a training, and in one of the students in this training had a cleft palate, right? And when she was a child, she was bullied for it. She was just, you know, harassed for this. And so as we're working here, she's going inside and contacting this place, you know, this child that had these experiences. And then she says the phrase, I'm ugly, right? And so I think most people that are therapists would want to sort of alter that experience a little bit. We would want to make it better. We might even say that, oh, even though you thought you were ugly, right? So my suggestion is, you know, the more we can ally with that reality, the more we can just purely let the truth of the client's experience arise and join with it, the better, right? Because anytime we try to make it different, anytime we try to make it nicer, then I think that their system is saying, well, you're not with me anymore, You don't know what it was like to have this experience. So partly one of the things I would say is we have to go for the nightmare, right? And let it arise in the container the way that it lives in her system, as with as much fidelity as it lives in her system.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like if you were doing psychedelic assisted work around this letter, like you would just. And I've seen you do this, you know, in person. And you also talked about it on Back from the Abyss, about just turning it up. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, not trying to calm her, soothe her, reassure her, distract her, but like turn the heat up on this and let it just go up and sit with it and percolate.
Well, I mean, I would say, so, you know, our one of our primary interventions is something called selective inhibition. And what we're doing with that is we're essentially inhibiting management strategies, inhibiting avoidance strategies, coping strategies, deep breathing, you know, all of those things. So I would say we're not actually even purposefully turning the pressure up, right? All we're saying is, let's see what happens to your system if you do nothing to manage it whatsoever. Mm. And it so happens that the system heads in that direction, right? If the system headed in a, you know, much more resource-loving, beautiful direction, as long as it was associated, wonderful. We would follow the client in that direction. But the fact is that if there's compromise in the system, particularly if there's compromise in the nervous system here, the system's attracted to the compromise, right? And that makes sense, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, would you classify that as a kind of inner healing intelligence that, if left to itself, it will, again, as you said, it will turn up the heat itself. It will, and then eventually resolve.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. I think inner healing intelligence can be thought of in a lot of different ways. Certainly one of those ways is sort of a biological inner healing intelligence, right? Mm. That, you know, our nervous system, you know, this very palpable biological layer of our being has homeostatic self-correction as part of it.
Yeah.
Right? And so it heads there. So here's another way to look at this, right? That, I mean, look at how many places in our lives there is an impulse for reenactment, right? So
everywhere.
We're constantly reenacting. Yes. And so, I mean, just to mention a couple of examples. So first of all, there's the intrusive imagery. That's part of PTSD, right? Mm. And John Breyer talks about that as being, you know, the brain's attempt to kind of, you know, place these images of the trauma in front of us so we can engage with it and work with it. There's, you know, the type of reenactment that we have where, you know, when you're 18 years old, you run away from your family, you move halfway across the country, only to form another family that looks exactly like the one you just ran away from. Mm-hmm. And maybe the roles are different, right? Maybe you're playing a different role in it, but it's the same structure, right? Then there's somatic reenactments that we see where body parts take on a role for the system, meaning that, you know, if there was perpetration involved in a traumatic event, then people can have their parts of their own body, like their hand, take on the role of perpetrator to sort of play this out. And then the final, the big one that I think most people are familiar with is, you know, how we reenact through transference, right? How we reenact through, you know, finding people and then projecting our childhood relationships onto our current relationships, you know? And so my question is, okay, why there's so many pathways and the system seems pretty hell-bent on taking us back to the scene of the crime, right? Taking us back and saying, hey, look, this is a piece that you have to deal with now. And insofar as our coping mechanisms are effective, insofar as our dissociation is effective, I think those impulses for reenactment end up not working so well, right? And we're just suggesting, okay, let's get the coping out of the way and let's see the reenactment.
That's a great phrase. Let's get the coping out of the way.
Yeah. The coping is just slowing down the healing.
Says Saj, get the coping out of the way.
Yeah. I can see a t-shirt now with it. Enough with the coping.
Yeah. But wow, what a powerful summary of somatic work, would you say? Of somatic therapy and just... Mm-hmm. Right, that so much of what we're doing is trying to take us away from what we need to be doing.
Yeah. The system knows, if we're going to trust the innate healing intelligence of the system, then trust it, right? Mm-hmm. Let it go to these awful places. I don't think it's random. I don't think it's, you know, bad wiring that our systems are trying to take us back to these places.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Even what about like the, you know, the reenacting with abusive or neglectful relationships?
Yeah. Well,
you could imagine and think, well, maybe that needs to happen because that's part of this process of needing to work through it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're left with the question, why does that continue to happen in people's lives? Mm. Right. And what's missing about this experience that if we could get this in place, then hopefully, the reenactment doesn't have to happen all the time. Right. So, you know, when we work with transference and therapy, we're inviting the reenactments to happen in the therapeutic relationship, mm-hmm. you know, where there's boundaries, there's hopefully a skilled clinician that sort of doesn't get indoctrinated into the reenactment and sort of, have a boundary violation, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think our system wants to reenact, and it'll either do it in our relationships out in our lives, or we can do it in a therapeutic container where that relationship is disposable, right? Mm. It's like, no, these reenactment patterns will cause, they'll crunch up relationships.
Yeah.
Right. And just for the system to find wholeness, just for the system to sort of get on the other side of this really, awful experience that crushed somebody in their childhood, and now they're coming back from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Anything else you want to add or leave it at that?
I'll share one quick story with mm-hmm. you and see how this fits in, Craig. But I remember doing a session with a client, and this was years ago, and she was working with ketamine, and part of her somatic reenactment is her neck muscles got incredibly tight and started pulling her head backwards until it was sort of hyperextended, right? And this was a first session, and it was kind of intense experience, and I asked her, like, would it be better if we put a pillow back there, right? And she said, yeah, let's do that. So we interrupt the process, put a pillow back there, and then she went back into, that selective inhibition where we're not managing anything. And so her neck and head did the same exact thing, went backwards, but then at this point, found the pillow and was resting on the pillow and wasn't nearly as painful. And she hung out there for, three, four, maybe even 5 minutes. And then she said, nope, the pillow's not working. It has to be gone. And so we took the pillow away, and then her head continued to go back. And of course the pain showed up. And then there was this sort of, movement pattern that showed up in terms of the neck and through the autonomic nervous system. This is all to say that I think pain is not random in mm-hmm. our process. I think pain is absolutely a part of the reenactment that tends to happen, and part of the reassociation. So basically, she was well aware that this movement, this pain, was coming from her. Right, there was an internal knowing that she had that this was her energy creating this, and I think that's very common for people that are doing this type of work. As the somatic reenactments are taking place, it's painful, but they're very well aware, intuitively aware, I would say, that this is their life energy creating this. It's not random. It's not coming from someplace else. This is them, and so they can tolerate it because they can sense that this is innate healer working through pain. As adults, we can sit back and talk about attachment and talk about, how this is, my attachment went wrong here, and we can talk about it almost from a removed position. But if we were to actually experience what that was like for a child, right, in a child's world, how, a child that had to cry themselves to sleep, a child that, just wasn't getting her needs met, and to reassociate to that experience, there is absolutely going to be pain as part of it. Mm. I don't think there's any way around it.
Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting. Every time I sit down and talk to you, I learn a lot. And plus, it's just really fun to sit with you. So
yeah.
Thank you. And probably my sheets are almost dry in your dryer.
Yeah.
I think. All right. We should go check this.
They're ready to go.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Sash.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Why don't some patients get better? As I've explored in previous episodes, trauma is one of the strongest predictors of psychiatric treatment resistance, especially early childhood abuse or neglect. Treatment-resistant depression? Think trauma. Treatment-resistant anxiety? Again, think trauma. Laura's letter described early childhood neglect and chronic dissociation. She wondered if she was broken. I again can't help but think about the differences between attachment, which appears to be a neurodevelopmental process with a specific window of opportunity, which then eventually closes, and love, which might be conceptualized as a psychospiritual phenomenon that doesn't have a specific developmental time window. I know patients who have severely damaged attachment, but have found a way to love and be loved. Maybe we can have chronically damaged attachment, but still develop our capacity for love, whether through formal therapy and or healing relationships with others, including companion animals and nature. I'm also thinking here of what Saj said today and in prior episodes. Quote, pain is part of the treatment. You have to go to the places and spaces that you want to avoid. And, quote, the common factor of all effective trauma treatments is that they are experiential. And, quote, so many people are walking around in a nightmare, and then they build a functional life on top of that nightmare, and we have to go for the nightmare and let it arise in the therapy container. And then last month, in the Love and Therapy episode, think about what Adele said as she described her trauma healing as, quote, trench work, unquote. Dissociation protects us from the annihilation of emotional and physical trauma, yet it also prevents us from meaningfully engaging in the world, in relationships, and in therapy. We have to start to feel all of it, the good, the bad, and the unspeakable, and then, and only then, begins the path forward.